You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras, the number one podcast for bow hunting product information and hunting stories from across the nation. And now, here's your nine-fingered host, Dan Johnson.
Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully everyone had a great weekend. And depending on if you're listening to this after the Super Bowl, or on Monday morning, hopefully you had a great Super Bowl party. I am the kind of guy who likes to not even sit down to watch the game. I just kind of hover over all the food and pick at it and eat it until my stomach is either full and I'm very uncomfortable, or it's time to leave. And that's kind of how I celebrate Super Bowl Sunday, and it's with food and not necessarily about the game, because to be honest with you, I could care less of the outcome of this Super Bowl. Now, what are we going to talk about today? Today, I got the guys from Land and Legacy on the podcast, right? You guys know the Land and Legacy podcast. It's on this same RSS feed. It's on the Sportsman's Nation podcast network. And today I talk with Adam Keith and Matt Dye, and we discuss the topic of, can money buy big bucks? And it's kind of in addition to a conversation that I had on Facebook with many of you. I posted the comment, I believe it was something along the lines of, you know, if I gave you 1,000 acres and $15,000 annually for habitat improvement in Iowa, do you feel that you could harvest a Boone and Crockett buck on it in multiple years in a row? And we talk about that today. We talk about, can money buy big bucks? And if you throw a lot of money on a farm, will it get you giant deer like what you see on the television shows? And again, that's what we talk about today. So I was excited to have this BS session with the Land and Legacy guys. It was an eye opener, because I wanted them on the show because they actually know what it takes to get deer to stay on pieces of property, as far as nutrition, genetics, what it takes to actually grow and hold big deer on a farm, and because of their habitat improvement background, as well as, you know, we also discuss the equation of a big buck. So what plus what plus what plus what equals big deer? And just a very fun, lighthearted conversation that wanted to spark some additional conversation on it, and on all the social media, right? Whether that's Facebook or Instagram. When I post this, please, I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on the topic as well. So that's what we talk about today. I'll keep this short because the podcast itself runs longer than normal, because we do cover a lot of different topics in this podcast. And I just want to make sure we get through absolutely everything. Commercial today, Ozonics, right? You guys know that I am a huge believer in ozone technology, right? From in the field applications, like what the ozonics does, right? You're hanging it in the tree and all the ozone is covering your scent downwind, right? You guys know that I am a huge believer in that, and I just feel more comfortable in the tree with that. It allows me to have more opportunities, because that deer that do come in downwind to me don't bust me as much as the past, and more opportunities equals more opportunities. When you have more deer inside shooting range, you're going to have more opportunities to harvest the animal of your desire, whether that's, you know, a doe, a yearling buck, whatever it is your goal is. The more opportunity you have at deer, the more opportunity you have to, you know, complete your goal. So huge fan of Ozonics. And then the out of the tree applications as well, like the ozone closet, where I can put my unit in this closet. I can dry wash all of my clothes, kill all the bacteria all over my hunting gear, and I feel confident going into the timber with an ozonics and what it can do for me from the scent elimination side of things, as well as it allows me to be a little bit more aggressive in the strategy department when I'm cutting the wind very hard, trying to be in that position where if that wind shifts just a little bit, there's a potential that that ozone is blowing right into the wind. So it allows me to be a little bit more aggressive, and I don't know. I just feel very confident when I use that product, and I've seen nothing but good things with it. So if you want to find out more information, go to ozonicshunting.com, and you need to enter the discount code 9Fingers. That's the number 9 followed by the word fingers, 17. 9Fingers, 17, no spaces, and you will be able to save $75 off of all orders over $400. Now, that's a very good discount, and please go take advantage of it and support this company because they support this podcast. So without further ado, let's get into today's, I'm just going to call it, it's a very big BS session with the guys from Land and Legacy. Can money buy big bucks? All right, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. And today I have some fellow Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network. I don't know, are you guys alum or what's the term? We're on the same network, but
veterans,
old-timers.
Yeah.
Old-timers. I guess, I like that.
The 9Fingers Chronicles and the Land and Legacy were the first two podcasts on the Sportsman's Nation.
Yeah, we're the elders.
The OGs, original gangsters.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's a little bit intimidating, right? So it's, oh my God.
You have street cred right out the gate, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm here with Matt Dye and Adam Keith, and they are the Land and Legacy podcast. And if you've heard this podcast, the 9Fingers Chronicles, I'm sure by now you've heard the Land and Legacy podcast. And these guys are the authority when it comes to
uh-oh.
Hey, I gotta build you up so like the people who listen think, hey, these guys really know what they're talking about.
Yeah, you're doing a great job. Keep it up.
Okay. So we got the Land and Legacy guys, and their podcast obviously revolves around habitat and, habitat improvement and all that good stuff. And that's why we have kind of a meeting of the minds today, because a while ago, I pretty much asked the question on Facebook and I got a variety of different answers. And the question was, can money buy big bucks? And I think that's what I want to have this podcast be about today, is can money buy big bucks? And the first thing that I want to do is set some kind of ground rules, right? So in a high fence scenario, yes, obviously, if I wanted to shoot a 200-inch deer, I could go pay for it in a high fence, right? Do you guys agree?
Totally, 100%, yes.
Okay, so that right there, we're not going to talk about that because that's a no-brainer. Yes, you can do that. Now, outfitters are something that I want to touch base on because, again, that's, some outfitters are high fence, some outfitters are low fence. And for the low fence outfitters, they have to manage their property for their clients, just like, let's say, a private landowner anywhere else, to try to get, quote unquote, big bucks. So I think the first thing that I want to talk to you guys about is what I call the big buck equation. And the big buck equation is this plus this plus this plus this, or however many categories there are, equal a big buck. And for the sake of conversation, I want to go big, and I want to say 170 inches. Okay. That's something that the hunting industry and television and advertising focuses a lot on. And so I want to make this hard to accomplish And as we all know, a 170-inch deer is, for the most part, pretty rare when you talk about the nation as a whole and whitetail bucks as a whole, okay? So I'm gonna throw it to you guys now, and I'm going to say, what is the big buck equation?
That's a heck of a question. Way to get it started. Very
I'm going to ask the vaguest question possible and need you guys to go into detail.
Yeah, thanks. We appreciate that one. But, you know, there's so much that goes into it. And I think automatically, and it's probably going to be a working equation as we talk it out here. But the big three things that right off the bat have to be included in this is age, nutrition, and security. Those three things are incredibly important to getting any deer to upper age classes and expressing their full potential, no matter where you're at in the country.
Okay. So you said age, nutrition, and security. All right. So let's go into each one of these things and break it down even just a little bit further. Okay. So as we all know, and you know, if you guys, for those of you who are listening to this podcast, you've heard us talk a lot about, you know, on the Land and Legacy side and even on the Nine Finger Chronicle side, we talk about, you know, if you want a deer with big antlers, you have to let them get a certain age, right? So in a perfect world, in this world that we are creating, you know, to make this big buck, what kind of ages should we expect a whitetail buck to get to before we can really start saying, hey, I think we should shoot him, or, you know, where we start seeing this 170 class deer?
I think that totally depends on where you're at in the country, first and foremost. But typically, just very average, we're looking at 3.5-year-old deer expressing 70 to 75% of its antler growth potential. And then at 4.5, it's 85 to 90. But there's a lot of state, or a few states, I should say, Iowa, even parts of northern Missouri, Illinois, Kansas, where once they hit 4.5, they just keep going up to where you see some people passing deer till they're 6.5, just because they know they're probably going to go over that 200-inch range. But for the most part, if you're talking PA, Pennsylvania, 3.5-year-old may still only be a 110. So to try and get a deer over 170, like our goal is, I think it's going to be, the age part is very tricky, and it all just really depends on where you're at.
And what he means is, in relation to where you're at, is how much nutrition is available for those deer to be able to, you know, consume on a yearly basis, on a daily basis, get exactly what they need to express that potential, their full potential at 3.5. Or let's say Pennsylvania, since it was used earlier there, you know, that deer, he may not be getting everything he needs based on the lack of food or the lack of management in an area or the closed canopy forest. So he, even though at 3.5 could be expressing 70, 75% of his potential, he may not have the resources that's going to allow him to do so. So even within age, they're still dependent upon nutrition as well, if that makes sense.
Right? Yeah, and the other thing, Matt, I think you said age, nutrition, and security. They all three are like tied together so much, because for a deer to have the age, he needs security to where he can get the age. So I think it's all same thing, the habitat speaking. Oh, what do you know, Matt and I going back to habitat. But it's a question of going back to the PA, where it doesn't have the nutrition, but might not even have the security to make it of the age.
Right, right. So would you say that, you know, in a weighted equation, all of these things hold the same value? So let's say I even added location down in here now. So we have age, nutrition, security, and location, right? So if we say each one of those things is 25%, they're all equal to the makeup of a big buck, or is there one thing that is kind of trumps everything else or trumps a couple other ones?
I think I'm interested, because I think you called this a BS session, is because Matt and I talked about this a lot, and it seems like we're kind of going around and around, but I'm curious to know what his take is. I'm going to say age, because here in the Ozarks, where you don't get a lot of 170-plus deer, it's always in an area to where it seems like, oh, okay, Mark Twain National Forest, somebody killed a 180. Well, the good chance, oh, where'd he kill it at? Oh, where he could get old.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to kind of divert for a second here, Dan, and ask your addition of location onto that equation. We brought it up, but I think that location is one of those things that, man, it's just not as important. And I probably turned some ears with that, because even Southern Ozarks, hey, we can get deer over 170. Arkansas, we can get deer over 170. Alabama, deer on a general basis get killed over 170 there. It is the other factors that I think influence,
gotcha,
in certain locations, if the majority or if more deer can get to that age class where they can, I guess, reach that 170 point. Areas like Kansas, where it's a one buck state, or what's another one I'm thinking of here?
I'm going to jump in on that debate, if you will, and say location isn't important. But if we're looking at the quickest way to get to a 170, of course it's important, because, sure, you can go somewhere and say, okay, huh, look, I put the trail cameras out and there's already three deer over 170.
Yeah, right. You have a better chance in certain areas for sure, but it doesn't mean that it can't happen. You just may have to be, let's say, allocating other resources to maybe nutrition in that area, and then you'll be able to get that buck to 170 or a deer to 170. But I think in many, many cases, most regions, if you have everything the deer needs, those three important factors, you can get deer to 170. Right. I'm a firm believer in that.
Right. So let's say some of these high pressured states, or states that, you know, when I say Michigan, when I say Pennsylvania or New York, those states are typically not a big buck state. Well, because there's millions and millions of hunters who go out and shoot basically anything that moves, right? So,
yeah.
So the age class, the age structure is lower. Do you feel that if some of these states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, I don't know, let's say said no hunting for 2 years, and let's just say this is, you know, all these questions are hypothetical. This podcast is going to be all hypothetical questions. The, sure, the age ratio, you know, there's no additional deer born, or I don't even know how to say this, but no hunting for 2 years in New York, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And every buck gets a chance to get 2 years older. Do you feel that we get to start seeing, I mean, do those states have what it takes based off of just letting them age to get to more of a 170 type rack on their head?
Well, there's
complex question.
Well, the thing that you have to weigh in is, okay, if I don't have as many deer hunters out there, then the amount of forage that's going to be out there is going to be less, because now there's so many deer,
right,
that are out there. So your food
stress,
supply, is less. Hunters play such an important role in managing wild deer herds. It's actually really, really important. So if you let that go for 2 years, one, you're going to have less food, but two, yes, I think you would see more deer, because you're just allowing, it's just a probability, you're allowing more deer to get to an upper age class,
okay,
in which they can express more potential.
I would rather see, you would get there quicker if you said, rather than saying, okay, you can't shoot a deer for 2 years, and the flip side of that is you can only shoot does, you would get there a lot quicker.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
For sure.
All right. So now going back to this 170 mark, right? You said that at somewhere around 3-year-old, you know, 3-year-old, they're reaching 75%, and then 4-year-old, they're even reaching a higher, you know, what would you say, 80 to 85%?
80 to 90.
Okay. And are those, where are those statistics from?
the QDMA has presented, and a lot of research supports those figures and those age classes representing or getting to express that much potential in their antler growth. A lot of captive deer herds have been studied and seen that.
Okay. So then the rest from four-year-old and higher, with the right nutrition and with the right security, they have an opportunity to reach even higher than that, moving into, let's say, 5, 6, 7 years old.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So is there a magic age, right? If we're going to build a deer, you know, if we have this 10,000 acres and there's one deer on it through its entire life that we're going to watch, and year one, he's got a 120-inch rack, right? And we're going to be like, I'm going to watch this deer until he hits 170. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because people do that, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. People do that. They watch a deer and they'll watch him. And then it's like, okay, well, now he's 200 or he's 170. Yeah, it's time to kill him. And so what do you think, if you're going to build this deer, what age is he going to be when we harvest him?
I'm going to let him get to at least 5.5.
Okay. Yeah.
If I have that much control, that much acreage, and know what's being harvested, what's not on a property, 5.5 would be the minimum.
Okay.
But once you get up there in age class, and you run into other things that just happen to deer of older age, you know, they might be more susceptible to, I guess
he may get in a fight and get his eye knocked out.
Yeah. I mean, you have no idea, or their eyesight goes down, in upper age class.
He gets hoof rot and he starts. Yeah. Yeah, but I think, and it all depends on the deer too, because I would want to watch that deer as at two and say, okay, here he is in two. Oh, he took a huge jump to get to when he got to 3.5. Oh, okay. Took another huge jump at 4.5. And maybe I'm targeting 4.5 and older, but I see how big of a jump he made at 3.5 to 4.5. I'm like, I want to see what he does from 4.5 to 5. Yeah. And then from that jump, it's a huge jump. And I say, okay, well, next year he may put on a lot more mass. Yeah. And, so I'm going to let him jump one more time, or his jump from 4 to 5 wasn't that big. And so I'm going to go ahead and take him out at 5.5.
Right. Okay. So I heard a stat once. I heard a guy who raised deer, and he told me, and maybe you guys can tell me I'm right or wrong on this, but at the end of a deer's fourth year, a whitetail buck, at the end of his fourth year, the skeletal system stops growing, and it goes from growing to all the nutrition now goes to maintaining that. So it takes less nutrition to maintain than to grow, and then that's when, in a, I guess, a perfect world, you see the biggest antler jump from the four-year-old to the five-year-old.
When you say biggest antler jump, do you mean total inches? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, I guess total inches. That's what I heard.
I mean, if you look at the stats, I guess, that we were talking about earlier, for a deer from 3 to 4, go from 75 to roughly 90, percent, that's a 15% increase. And then from 4 to upper age classes, he's only got about 10% more to grow. So
okay.
To me, that doesn't add up. It doesn't add up because, again, from a 2-year-old, he's going to go from about 50% of his antler growth to a 3, and then he's going to put on an extra 25%. He's going to increase that much. Now, he might only be 50 inches, and then increase 25% of that, and put on another, 13, 14 inches, whatever it may be. But he's still increasing a larger increase than he would from 2 to 3 than he would from 4 to 5 if he maintains. And these are all averages too. You know, this is what over time a sample size has projected, you know, roughly 50% at 2. Roughly 75% at 3.5, and so on and so forth.
Like, there's a lot of variables. There may be a stretch where the 3.5-year-old bucks that are getting ready to make the biggest jump at 4.5, that year is a horrific drought, mm-hmm. and there's just no food.
Right.
And so, what do you know? It's another variable thrown into this mix.
Right, absolutely. And I've seen that on trail cameras firsthand, where, you know, leading the year after a drought, typically the year of the drought, I don't see a decline in the antler growth. But the next year, I see a bit of a drop in total antlers, like total inches of antler. When I mean total inches, I mean across all the bucks that I check on trail camera, right?
Sure.
I've seen them go down. Now, last year was a very mild winter, right? And this year, I saw a huge jump in antler size because of the mild winter and the access to food, right, was there. And the deer really didn't have to struggle as much as they've done in the past. So, sure. You know, just
one of the things to certainly consider is, and oftentimes it's because it doesn't fall within the hunting season. Not that many people are focused on their deer herds at this time of the year, but late February, March is an incredible stress period for deer. There's very little forage available throughout much of the landscape, really woody browse, or if you have winter wheat fields, there's about it. And then at that point, their fat deposits that they've tried to store up through the wintertime are depleted. And if you get cold temperatures, late February, March, or ice, that's a very stressful time period. And then they have to basically get to a certain threshold coming out of spring just to basically rebuild or maintain, get to that point that they can now begin improving and gaining weight, because antlers are a secondary sexual characteristic. So they have to maintain their body at a certain level first and foremost. Then the additional resources above and beyond that point goes into antler production. So if they come out of spring depleted, they have to build up and then produce antlers on top of that. Whereas if it's a milder winter or you have the resources available during that time in the habitat or standing grain, whatever it may be, they don't have to climb back up to that threshold. They can green up, just boom, start putting on inches of antler and go on. So that time period is really important for predicting, I wouldn't say predicting antler growth, but getting a good start to an antler growing season.
Gotcha. So going back to the original question before we ranted out on that, my friend is a liar, is what you're telling me. The guy I know is a liar, and I'm going to call him out, and I'm going to tell him you guys said that. All right, so 5.5 years old, right? So we're going to let deer get to 5.5 year old years old,
yeah,
on average, right? So yeah. Now we're going to talk a little bit about nutrition, and I have a feeling that this is also going to be that location, you know, where we talk about location as well. So we have the ability to get them to 5.5 years old. Now we need to talk about where this farm is going to be and the nutrition that's going to be on this farm to get them the nutrition that they need to reach their max antler potential.
Yeah, let's do it. Honestly, I think this is another one of those things that's okay. Location, you know, you have those hot spots across the country, and all that is really directed back to the land use of that area and soil
basically
type.
Long term or short term benefits. You look at the landscape that Matt just said, the location where you typically see the big deer come from is where it's generally crop country. There's a lot more food available. Where you see deer that aren't as big coming from is where the crop is timber, pine trees, oak trees. It may take 80 years or 60 years to do a harvest, and versus a harvest every year or planting a crop every year that's just nothing but food in the form of soybeans or wheat or whatever it is.
On a couple podcasts ago, we talked about was the value of food plots. And if you look at mature closed canopy forests per acre, they're producing about 50 to 100 pounds of digestible forage a year. And that's not much for 1 acre when you compare it to a soybean, which is anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 pounds of forage. And you know, right there off the bat, you're going to have a big difference. And certainly in those areas, based on land use, how people are utilizing the land, that's going to predict a lot of, you know, I guess how big a deer can get, if that's available to them or if it's not.
Okay. So Let's take food plots out of the equation right now, right? We all know that food plots are a huge benefit to any piece of property, and we're going to bring them back into the equation in just a little bit. But what kind of landscape are we looking at that is going to provide the best possible nutrition for a whitetail buck?
Flat. How about that?
Flat.
Yeah. Wow, great answer, Adam.
Yeah. Honestly,
and that's all, folks. Have a good night.
Done. We're out of here. That's a great question, Dan. And early successional habitat is the key for that. And that may be in the form of, let's say, Oklahoma, Kansas. If you've got tall grass prairies and you have a lot of forbs mixed in, those forbs are going to provide a lot of great forage for deer. And you may not have the food plots, the crops in that area, but you still have incredible amount of deer food. And then you look at a timbered area that is that's been recently cut, a cut over or planted pines that's been thinned. You have regrowth in the form of brambles, in the form of other forbs that come back and grow. Those early successional plants are going to support and provide a large majority of the tonnage that those deer and other wildlife species are going to consume throughout an entire year.
Gotcha.
I think that's basically the difference between when I say flat, typically that's crop country, but even Kansas has some hills. And I think the biggest difference in a roundabout way, or I guess trying to keep it short, is where is the growth? Is it within a deer's reach or is it out of a deer's reach? Whether it's flat or rugged terrain, if it's in the form of a 100-foot tall tree, whatever it is, it's out of the reach. But if it's in the form of from the soil to 4 foot tall, whether it be a native forb or soybean, deer is going to make a lot better living off that.
Okay. Is there a specific – now let's throw food plots back into it, right? Is there a specific food plot – and you guys are the food plot kings. If you could only plant one food plot, and not to kill a deer, but to give a deer the best possible nutrition, what are you planting?
Oh, gosh.
Do we get to say multi-species plots, or is it like one crop?
I don't care. This is guys, we haven't followed anything on this podcast so far. So you guys can ask yourself a brand new question if you want and go from there.
This is not how I expected this podcast to go. I had all my notes ready too. And I was thinking, you know, Dan, I saw how much conflict or debate was going on in that Facebook post, and we were the guests. Yes, come on. He must want our careers to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And you've just been hammering us with the questions.
No, I'm going to wait till the end of the podcast to do that.
Okay, great.
Now let's get through this little bit of fame here first. Thanks.
You know what? That's a very loaded question, because I got to ask, how big are the food plots? Because if you tell me that it's less than an acre, I'm not even going to try soybeans, because I know they're going to get hammered for the most part, unless I can fence them off. But then that's not providing any forage during the summer. It's going to take a lot of seeds per acre to combat for the fact that it's a small food plot. And so if it's less than an acre, I'd much rather go with clover, something that can take the browse pressure. Matt,
I totally agree on that. If you've got the amount of acres that you can, you know or have the insurance that, hey, I'm going to have standing grain or forage through soybeans throughout the entire summer and know I'm going to have that standing grain in the fall time, man, soybeans are very, very tough to beat. But in many cases, you're limited by whether it is open ground or the ability to clear ground or the ability to have flat enough ground to be able to plant successfully. So again, that's a loaded question, but I mean, soybeans, they're very tough to beat. But again, in that small plot situation, like Adam said,
they're easy to beat.
They're very easy to beat because the deer are going to beat them down.
Gotcha.
When you say we're the food plot guys, I guess We typically are more, I don't know, a little bit different than some folks that I've seen, just because we like to promote multi-species food plots, just because you can provide forage basically throughout the year with that planting. They all serve to be a great food source at different times during the year. And so I would much rather do that, but that doesn't really answer your question.
Yeah. And while we're on the subject, I'll say I never want my food plots to be carrying my deer throughout the entire year, because again, we can have droughts. We can have other instances where crops are failure, maybe army worms or whatever. But if I have a good basis and I'm managing my native forage and providing a large percentage of the deer's diet in native browse, then I know my food plots are simply going to supplement and provide attraction and carry them through certain periods of the year, but basically draw them out during daylight hours to be able to harvest them. Food okay. plots to me and us is definitely a hunting strategy, but it can be an important part of anyone's management plan.
Gotcha. Okay. So as you were talking, I was scrolling through Facebook and I found the question that I originally asked, right? And it got like almost 200 people comment on it. Okay. So, and it was a variety of answers all across the spectrum. And here's what the question was. If I gave you 1,000 acres in southern Iowa and a budget of $15,000 annually for habitat improvement and food plots, how long do you think it would take you to kill a buck with a bow over 170 inches?
Do you really have $15,000 to give us?
Dude.
Sorry, that's all I took out of that.
I was thinking, man, why does he want to lead that job?
Is this where yeah. I, is this where I edit in a Land and Legacy commercial for you guys?
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Boy, I'm going to sound really cocky and probably in this answer, but I'll first say, now it sounds great, but if you got the 1,000 acres and you had three terrible neighbors or a bad road system that went right through the middle of it, that would definitely be a hurdle you would have to overcome. But if you were to give me 1,000 acres with the ideal situation and $15,000, I would be shocked if we couldn't do it in a few years.
Right, right.
And the reason for that is we go back to that big buck equation and we think about the age structure in that state or that portion of the state. We think about the nutrition that's available in that area, and we think about the security features. You got CRP, you got wooded draws that can hold and get deer to those upper age classes.
Yeah.
To me, it's not necessarily a matter, even if the $15,000 wasn't in that equation, to me, it's a matter of, can I kill the deer that are here? Because I know that 170-inch benchmark is likely running around on the property. It's not a matter of me managing and producing it, if you will. It's a matter of me killing it. And there's yeah. a big difference between having them on your place and killing them.
Right, absolutely.
Yes, I think that's kind of what Matt and I debated the whole time whenever you mentioned this a couple weeks ago about doing this podcast was, of course, money can buy big bucks, but it's really knowledge and understanding of the landscape to consistently kill those big bucks. And keeping it in mind, like for me, when you say 1,000 acres in southern Iowa, how long is it going to take? I think if you look at any 1,000 acre chunk or a lot, basically any chunk that's got trees on it or CRP or whatever, there's probably a good chance there's a really good deer in that area. But if you took 1,000 acres in South Carolina or Florida, even the Ozark Mountains where we're from, there's not many 170s running around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, it's most likely because of those other factors in that equation. But I think to answer the question is you could do it quicker in southern Iowa than you can do it in other places. Doesn't mean it's not possible in other places, obviously, because it happens every year. But the time and the resources may require more money or a longer time frame to accomplish that goal.
And what's the fun in that anyway, Dan?
Right. Right. Again, I would probably be the hypocrite right now. Let's say I hit the jackpot tonight or tomorrow, whenever they draw it. And although I don't play the lottery, but if I did and I won, you know, $40 million and I could buy the best possible, I go to whitetailproperties.com or whatever their website is. And I just kind of scroll through it. Hey, I want to buy this piece right here. You know, I spend $5 million on a primo piece of ground in Iowa. You know, I may not be good at hunting, I may not know shit about planting food plots or habitat improvement, but I could pay someone to do it. Or if I learn it myself and do it myself, I still have, you know, killing, like you said, killing them and having them on the property is two different things. So here's where I throw kind of my two cents in. And I feel that if I had the money and I could buy a primo piece of ground, right, in whether it was established or I had to put 2 or 3 years worth of work in it to get, you know, those 5.5-year-old bucks on the piece of property, right? I feel that if I had the money to plant a 15, 20, 30, 40, 50-acre food plot of, let's say, standing corn, and I put a shooting house on it, and I wait till late season to go and muzzleload hunt it, that at some point, you know, and there is also the, in this is luck, right? You and the deer have to cross paths at some point throughout a season in order for you to even get a shot on it, right? So I have a feeling that I could just sit in a shooting house and wait for late season when all these deer start piling out of the timber, and I would have a very good chance of killing the top tier bucks on these properties once I locate them with trail cameras. And I am a firm believer that money can buy you a big buck. If you go to, let's say, Iowa or Illinois, and you just blow money on a piece. Now that takes some of the fun out of it, because I would definitely want to manage it. And like, I think it would just be cool to have a chainsaw for a day and cut down like 40 trees.
A day, and all you cut down is 40 trees? What, do you cut down redwoods?
They're big ones. See, you guys are talking shit on my own podcast to me about habitat improvement, and I don't know anything about habitat improvement.
You realize that's why we were the first ones to come on the podcast, because he has no idea what he's talking about, you know?
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I don't.
I would say 100% I would back you up on most of your statement there. What I would say is, if you have an unlimited budget and you're just throwing money at it, that you could go into a lot of places in the U.S. outside of Iowa and Illinois and just buy a huge chunk of land and pour money into it and plant food plots and do all kinds of habitat stuff and get bigger deer than the neighborhood has. I think it's possible anywhere.
Okay. All right. So now we have genetics, and I want to talk a little bit about genetics, because there are farms that I've hunted, even in Iowa, that even had very low pressure, right? And if our magic number, let's say, is 170, that no matter how old the deer gets, if it's going to be an 8-pointer its entire life, there's a good chance it's not going to hit 170, right? So how big of a role do you guys think that genetics in a specific neighborhood plays into this whole thing?
Great question. And I think I'm going to go to expression of the genetics, because, again, just like that Pennsylvania, we'll go back to that scenario. There's been 170s killed out of Pennsylvania. And how do we know that some of the 10 pointers that are 4.5 or 5.5 that get killed out of Pennsylvania don't have the possibility of getting to that 170 mark if they're, you know, if they may only reach 140, but their genetics would allow them to if they had the resources, the nutrition available to get there, to express that. And I don't think there's a way to measure the lack of expression or the lack of reaching the full potential in an individual deer, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yes, it's important, but I think making sure that the resources are there is more important than trying to think about the genetics that are in place, because everyone talks about genetics, but how do they measure them? How do they measure, you know, a 4.5-year-old deer that's only a 140 as an 8-pointer and doesn't get any bigger? How do they know that there's not other internal things going on in that deer that's limiting that deer? It might have the genetics, but just can't express it.
Right.
I think, you know, for me, I've always heard, well, the Iowa deer and Northern Missouri deer are a different subspecies than Southern Missouri deer. And I've heard that. Even this year, I've heard it. But when we look back, whenever there was very few deer in Missouri, the herds that they used to restock the state were in Southern Missouri. So a lot of the Northern Missouri deer still have the same blood, same genetics that Southern Missouri deer have, but they're significantly larger because they have the nutrition available.
Right.
Even with body sizes, not even just antlers, just the body sizes increase more. And that's a factor of nutrition and basically the latitude in which they fall across the United States.
Okay. So I want to go to the opposite side of this spectrum right now. Let's say I still have the 1,000 acres. I buy the 1,000 acres of, you know, that is 100% secluded. I have the $15,000 to throw at it annually for habitat work and food plots and whatnot. Is there a state that is on the opposite side of Iowa to where, man, I would really be struggling to ever get a Boone and Crockett deer in this state, even if I did have the money and I did have the time and energy and surface area to put on a piece of property?
I think so. Yes. Florida comes to mind, South Carolina.
I guess the coastal regions of Georgia, South Carolina and Florida would come to mind. Honestly, the deer sizes are much smaller. But outside of that, I can't think of very many areas, if done correctly and promoting native forage, no matter what the soil condition is. There's been great research to support this, that no matter what the soil type is, the native forage is still going to provide its crude protein levels, which is meets the minimum requirements that deer need to express their full potential. So no matter where you're at, if you're in the northern portion of Georgia in the Appalachian Mountains, you can still, if you're promoting the right forages, produce great, great deer and get them to reach their genetic potential as you would in Iowa.
Right, right.
No matter the soil.
And you can throw in the whole feed them. Like if I had endless dollars, I could literally feed my deer all year round with supplemental feeding.
Yeah. Texas comes to mind.
Right. Right. Okay. So now 5.5 years old, right? We talked about that. Now what state, you know, if hypothetically best chances for a Booner, what state are you guys going to have your 1,000 acres in?
Southern Missouri, baby. I'm going to stay home. But I'm totally different than a lot of people. Yeah, sure. If I'm just on the market and I'm ready to kill big deer, I'm going to Iowa.
Okay.
But right. What's the fun in that? I like growing. I like the challenge of trying to grow them here at home.
Well, we really don't care what you think. Okay.
Hey, you got 40 trees to cut in a day. Okay. Lay off me.
Hey, I had to take a couple breaks.
Yeah. The Snickers bar and water was calling his name.
That's right. That's right. So,
you know,
yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. For me, it's a toss up between Kansas and Iowa. Those two states are just amazing. I love the scenery that they provide, the land use and the ability to manage those properties in a way that we typically would prescribe or recommend for a client. Man, you have great opportunity to do that in both of those states, but not to overlook
Oklahoma.
Yeah. Oklahoma's incredible.
If you were to ask me, and I'm just going to tell you what I'm looking to start an outfitting business and I'm wanting to get as many big deer as possible, I'm going to Southern Iowa or probably Kansas. But a state that's really starting to come up is Oklahoma. Yeah. I think it's like over 3,200 plus inches this year alone.
Right.
So I would definitely, those three would be my go-to states.
You guys, you know, Iowa used to be the sleeper state. Iowa is no longer a sleeper state. You guys think Oklahoma is the new sleeper state?
Potentially, yeah. I honestly, and that kind of gets into conditions of, okay, what's the weather been like? What's the climate been like? Because there's some portions that can be very arid. But I think if you got great growing seasons and good temperatures during the fall time to get deer on their feet moving, man, that's an awesome opportunity to kill some giants out there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we're in agreement. Let's just, for sake of not going deeper into the rabbit hole, a 5.5-year-old buck in southern Iowa on 1,000 acres, right? Okay.
That's the dream.
That's the dream. Okay. Now let's, you know, did you guys ever play the video game SimCity when you were younger?
No,
we were cutting more than 40 trees when we were five years old.
We were chopping wood,
yeah,
man.
Here we go. Jeez, here we go. You know, Iowa had a
nerd alert.
Yeah.
Nerd alert.
You know, Paul Bunyan.
You know, Iowa and Missouri had a war like back in the early 1800s.
Is this the start of the second one?
No. Well, Missouri, the people from Missouri threw dynamite across the Iowa line, and then the people from Iowa lit it and threw it back.
Oh, nice, huh? Funny.
Yeah, my grandpa told me that joke, and I never laughed at it either. So, I wonder if people have literally tuned out of this podcast yet.
I don't know, but they will after this joke. That's, you know, right. How we know that the toothbrush came from Iowa?
Oh, here we go.
Because if it was anywhere else, we'd call it a teeth brush.
Yeah, yeah. That's not the first time someone's said that joke on this podcast.
Oh, dang it, man. Yeah. Hey, well, Dan, we got great dad jokes, and we're not even dads.
You know? Dan, I think it was about the time when, early in the podcast, when you said I was going to put my 2 cents in, yeah. That's when they actually checked out.
Yep.
So we lost them at that point.
Oh, you guys are assholes. Anyway. I'm in my head right now, I'm rethinking this entire thing.
Well, when you invited us on, we thought, all right, he's trying to take us down, but we're going to take him down with us.
Two heads are better than one.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so we got this farm is now in, anyway, SimCity. Anyway, this video game. This video game, you could build cities, right? You build houses and commercial spaces and roads and everything, all right?
So, I'm aware of it, yep.
Yep, so here's the deal. We're going to build, now we're in Iowa, right? On this, on great soil, we're going to build the perfect farm. What does the perfect farm, in your guys' opinion, look like?
Oh, man.
Wow. Even more loaded.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's... lots and lots of grass and wildflowers and early succession, lots of shrubs, plum thickets and things like that. Then we've got
tillable ridge tops.
I mean, in an ideal situation, we're not worried about making income, so it's just food and cover and water, streams that are rocked bottom, so I don't have to worry about EHD as much. What else? Little water holes.
Honestly, for me, the big thing is cover. If you've got some topography mixed in with all of this, the relationship of cover to food and topography, that topography is going to really start bottlenecking deer as they're making their way from good cover to these food resources. And if we're leaving some, probably a large portion of the standing grain, I'm going to be looking at, okay, if a deer was bedding here in this sanctuary and he gets up to feed, and I want to bottleneck him, I'm going to look at that terrain and say, okay, to bottleneck him here in a transition area, I'm going to leave the standing grain over in an A spot. And I know that he's going to 9 times out of 10 walk through that bottleneck. So really it's the layout of the land and the terrain, and then the features that you're managing within that, really going to help predict and lay out the farm, make it that much more huntable.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I hunt a farm that kind of has one of those locations, right? It is a big, fat pinch point that at some point that is inside corner of a cattle pasture and a bend in a river. And in that space, there's where the timber pinches down hard, almost every deer that I have on trail camera at one point in the entire year, you know, typically during, you know, the late October to the last part of, you know, the end of November, Thanksgiving area, these deer cruise through this pinch point every day, right? Not every deer every day, but, you know, a deer are constantly going through this pinch point. And I think one of those on this property that we're building would be a huge plus.
Yeah, there's, again, like that's the terrain features and kind of the, how the habitat work to your advantage and disadvantage of the deer. And really, ideally, we'd have multiple of those throughout the property, whether that may be us manipulating the timber in a way or creating an ideal area that's great bedding cover that gets them to up and on their feet along this pinch point. Like I said, hopefully there's multiple of those throughout the place.
I think it's hard to, I'm trying to, while Matt was talking, try to think of a way to describe this, but in an ideal situation, I don't want it to look like I have, okay, 100 acres of bedding here, 100 acre food plot here, 100 acre timber here, 100 acres of this there. I would rather have 5 acres of food here, 10 acres of bedding there, 5 acres of timber here, a 2 acre pond. I would really want almost like polka dots scattered around. If you were to just color coordinate each area, so timber is red and food plots are green and yellow is grasses or bedding and orange is shrubs, I would want it to look like glitter of all those colors fell out on the table.
Yeah. Just like a shake Yahtzee, shake it up and throw it down on the ground.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
What's the benefit of that?
More edges.
Okay.
More edges, the ability to find those edges and even work, manage those edges and use edge feathering a little bit and basically steer deer. That's what the more edges you have, the better the ability to steer deer.
Gotcha. Yeah. So let's dive in a little bit because the original three categories were age, nutrition, and security. Talk a little bit more about what your guys' opinion of security is.
Habitat that allows deer to survive.
Not to just avoid escape and hide, but survive in as well.
But surviving as well. So ideal situation, you have a lot of growth where a deer lives. Four foot and down. And you have a lot of different types of vegetation within that scale of 4 foot and down. So you have grasses, you have flowers, you have shrubs, you have blown over trees, you have some hinge cutting, whatever it is, you have a whole mix of that within that range of 4 foot and down.
Okay. Makes sense. Thick, nasty stuff, right?
Thick, nasty stuff because they can hide in it. They're using their nose more than anything. So they're gonna hear you and use their nose to try and identify you. So basically by having that much habitat, they can hide and stay there and stay there and stay there until the last resort they have to get out of there. But if they are safe enough within that, they don't have to leave.
Okay.
There's a lot of times when we're, you know, either driving around a farm or touring a place and you're looking at honestly how the deer are escaping and what's that range in which they're getting up. You know, if let's say you're on a buggy, they're getting up 150 yards away from you. It might be wide open timber, but sometimes even like in the best cover, and I've been to lots of farms that have got ideal cover from that 4 foot and down range, and deer stand up. You see the tops of their ears and they'll crouch right back down.
Right.
And you just drive on or move on. They have the cover and the ability, even if you were to enter it and go to them to try and bump them, they can get out of there because right next door, a couple steps away, there's more cover and more cover and more cover. That allows them to not only bed down securely, but escape securely too.
So if you're bumping deer and they're way out in front of you, they're likely betting in the best cover, but they don't have the best cover. I guess that was kind of confusing, but you want them to be able to feel secure, and you get within, you know, let's say 50-ish yards or so without them blowing out.
Yeah,
Would be ideal.
For example, when we're touring a property and we're going along and it's wide open timber, we can see the deer out running out in front of us 100 yards away.
Or more.
But if they're in thick cover, you almost have to step on them sometimes. Or even if they do leave, you don't see them.
Right.
Because they've already left out in front of you. And the only way we know that is by we just toured a property not long ago. And we walked from one property was thick grasses and shrubs and just nasty thickets. And we had no idea how many deer we were bumping. We saw tracks.
Yeah, sign everywhere.
There was sign everywhere. But then we were meeting a guy, and he was sitting at the other end, and we basically pushed out the farm. And he goes, "Did you see all those deer you pushed out?" And we're like, "No." And he goes, "There must have been 30 of them." We had no idea. We went to the next farm that bordered it, open timber, open crop fields, and there was deer running 200-300 yards out in front of us. And you could see them forever. So we'd much rather have the thick growth.
And that provides them with the cover and the security and, with, let's say, peace of mind within that deer herd that, hey, I'm secure here. I'm safe here. I don't have to bolt and run and get the heck out of Dodge. I can meander or honestly, a lot of times they'll even loop back up and behind you and just come right back and squat. And you don't know that because you can't even see them. But that's quality security cover.
Right. Okay. All right. So, you know, this equation is not just age plus nutrition plus security, as we've already talked about, right? There's like sub equations off of each one, right? Where it's located, how the terrain sits, what the soil's like, all this other junk that goes into it. So it's not as complicated as it's a little more complicated than what we originally led on to. Now, you guys are in the habitat improvement, deer management type of, you know, you live that every day with what you do for a living. So if a guy like me, and what I don't even know how to ask this question, because I want to compare what we all see on outdoor television, right? We see these people going out and shooting giant deer every single year. And it's because they have what we just described, right? They have a large piece of low pressure property with a great age structure. They have great nutrition and they have great security, you know, on all those things. Now, from your standpoint, you know, a lot of guys see that and go, hey, these guys have a lot of money to throw at it and they're killing big bucks because of it. But what a lot of people don't see is all the work that goes into this property before the season even starts to be able to do that. Talk to us a little bit about that hard work that happens before you even step foot in a tree stand.
To me, it goes back to probability. And of course, like you said, they've got many of them have the ability to hunt very large tracts, and you just have more deer that are going to get to that 170 mark. And that's, of course, because of some of the standards in which they're holding out for through the years prior, and just the number of deer on these places and the habitat improvements that hopefully they've been doing. But what you said was you see them killing great deer every single year. But what a lot of the shows don't show is all the time that's put in the stand when they're not successful.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of the equation in that is how much time is allotted to be able to go out and not overpressure a farm and hunt basically every day of the season if they desired and make it happen in that manner. Again, that probability of time in the stand, you put all those other equations of habitat improvement, large property, good age structure, and a lot of time to stand, hey, you've got a good chance of killing a great deer.
Yeah, right. Well, what else do you guys want to add to this, right? So I guess first of all, Matt and Adam, I want to hear your own individual thoughts kind of as a overview or, you know, a wrap up on this. Can first off, can money buy big bucks?
Well, you told me earlier you didn't care what I thought. So is this is this permission to speak again? So I would say, yes, money can buy big deer. But like I said earlier, it's going to take knowledge and the understanding and woodsmanship to kill those big deer.
Right.
Now, you could pay somebody to plant all the food plots or do all the work and then tell you and spend the time scouting and say, okay, go sit in this tree, of course. So, yeah, money can buy big deer, and ultimately it could buy big mounts on the wall if you wanted.
Yeah.
For me, I guess the challenge, because how many of us actually have the amount of money that we can do all this? Not many.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is, how much money is it going to take to get the caliber of deer that I want, that I would be proud of? And then that goes with, I don't have much money at all. So I can't, how am I going to make this work? How can I get big deer when my budget is $300 in food plot seed and a chainsaw and a drip torch? Like, what can I do to get those deer? And that's kind of the challenge that I faced and still face today. I like that challenge, but maybe that's just me saying, yeah, I like this. I'd rather have it like this. But I would much rather try to find the, okay, what's the bare minimum to get the maximum potential?
Gotcha.
Yeah, I'm going to agree. Obviously, money can buy.
Of course, right?
Yeah, money can buy big deer and big deer on a yearly basis. There's no doubt. But I'm gonna suggest that in areas that may not typically produce big deer, let's say timbered areas, which cover a large portion of privately owned property across the country, if you manage your timber through TSI, maybe government programs, which puts money in your pocket.
Timber harvest.
Right. That allow you, if your timber's not in the state, to be able to make money off of, but doing those practices, that's going to improve the cover, improve the wildlife value of those acres, and then get you to a point where you can do a timber harvest, which puts money in your pocket that you can put back into the property. Now you've got the opportunity to increase the impact that you have on the property, on the whitetail herd, and maybe achieve those goals. And that, to me, is an avenue that I hope a lot of people are looking into. When we talk about closed canopy forest, man, there's just very little production in a wildlife standpoint that they typically offer. So if I can make money off that timber, if it is mature enough, there's a market for it, I would highly suggest getting a credible logger in there to do that. Put money in your pocket, you put it back into the property and manage it in a state that's most conducive to wildlife, and you're staring those numbers and those goals right in the face in a couple years.
All right. You uncorked the can of worms. So we're just going to keep, I'm going to stack on that of kind of what gets me excited. And of course, it would be awesome to get 1,000 acres in southern Iowa and be able to just dump money into it. But going back to what I just said prior to Matt speaking was kind of that, okay, what's the bare minimum that I can spend to still get great deer? But the other thing is, how many people hunt on farms that are cattle farms or their crop farms or their timber plantations? And so they have other hurdles to combat with. I grew up on a cattle farm. So it was right. Like, okay, there's a cattle operation going on. That's not going to change, but I still want to have better deer hunting and better quail hunting, better turkey hunting. So trying to mix in the cattle with the deer, with the turkey, with the quail, to where they're all benefiting and they're all reaching their maximum potential. And that's kind of that's the exciting thing for me, is taking a farm that's not just recreational, but it's a working cow farm. Maybe it's a beef cow. Maybe it's a dairy. Maybe it's a crop farm, to where they're harvesting a majority of the food and still trying to make it a world-class hunting property.
Right.
Yeah, I think most properties are underutilized, and the fact that, you know, people just say, oh, well, that's my cattle farm, this is my hunting farm. Hey, there's the opportunity to make both of those income producing and still have amazing hunting on there. So may think outside of that box and see how that lane really can best be used to your benefit.
I'm going to sound incredibly crazy when I tell you this, Dan, but if you were to say, okay, here's your ideal farm, build it, I still want cows involved. I know that sounds crazy, but understand, like, so Matt and I are consultants, but we're also land stewards, and I believe that large herbivores or grazing was a huge part of the ecosystem that benefited not only small birds, but benefited the whole system and benefited the land. So trying to incorporate that is what I really want to do. So, yeah, I bet you didn't expect that.
I didn't. Well, at the same time, though, you know, I hunt. The farm I hunt is my main farm is a fully operational. I mean, they have cattle and they have horses. Now, the horses, I don't even know what they have the horses there for other than to maybe keep the grass down so they don't have to mow. I mean, they just kind of do whatever they want, right? They're all over the place. And the deer kind of avoid some of those places where the horses or the cattle are. And that's almost a benefit for me from a strategy standpoint, because I know that they're not going to walk through the path right in through the middle of the pasture where the cows or the horses are. They're going to take kind of a different route, maybe around the pasture, staying on the edge or in the timber a little bit. So that might that actually helps me out a little bit. So
yeah,
from a strategy standpoint. Now, let's see here. You know, a lot of the guys who listen to this particular podcast are, you know, the DIY strategy guys. So is there, you know, we don't own our own properties. We don't lease our own properties. So habitat improvement isn't really something that's on our mind a lot, just because we don't, I mean, it's not. I mean, we can't plant food plots. We can't do, you know, timber harvest or stuff like that. So what kind of things should we look for to go in and find a location, I don't know, or do something to a piece of property that will maybe result in a buck maybe getting a little bit bigger or I think improving the property?
That's a great question, Dan. And I think it's whether you're doing the work or not, whether you're out there grunting it out and cutting trees, planting food plots, or if you don't have that opportunity, it's still very, very important to understand what's going on and why someone would be doing that. Why would someone be cutting trees? And then how are what's the wildlife going to respond? How, as a result of the trees being cut, should I hunt this area? A lot of state lands, a lot of national forests either get prescribed fire or have those periodic timber harvest. And there's such a strong, obviously, relationship between the land use and the wildlife. So if you're a guy who's a DIY hunter on state lands or public land, knowing what that means when you see logging trucks coming out of your hunting area, you need to know, okay, down the road, what's going to come back? Is that going to be beneficial? Most likely, yes. And when is that going to be beneficial? When are the wildlife going to be using it so that you're in there at the right time of the year to be able to hunt it and hopefully wrap a tag around that deer? Whether you're implementing it or not, it's extremely important to have the knowledge of what's going on, what's going to come back, and then how the wildlife is going to respond to it and how you can best use it to your advantage in a hunting strategy.
I'm going to piggyback on that and say, you know, you're hunting public ground. And for me, the strategy is all about security. Now, you could have, and hear me out on this one, because maybe you thought it was food or something else. But if you have a 100-acre food plot or a ag field and there's no security around it, chances are deer aren't going to be there during daylight hours. So it doesn't matter if they're going there at night. You can't hunt them. So it's finding the security. And sometimes on public ground, the security is in the oddest places. It could be the road ditch or the little strip of timber that doesn't look like much, but since it doesn't look like much, that's why the deer have now figured out that it doesn't get walked through. There's not as much human scent or predator scent in that little strip of timber. So they've associated that as the safest place, even though it doesn't look like much. So that's what I always based my hunting strategy off of on public ground, was finding the securest location to where there was better chance of seeing a deer on its feet during daylight hours.
Right.
And that area may not have the best cover either, but it's the security feature. We're talking about sanctuaries. We want good cover and security. The two things go hand in hand. What Adam's talking about is strictly security, because sometimes the areas with the best cover have the most pressure, but it's finding those areas that get overlooked and then hunting them. And that's where a lot of deer seek the security.
And it could be the place that's right next to the shop where there's trucks and people in and out of there all day. But for some reason, now the deer have associated those people with a non-threat. So they'll bed in. They're basically, in turkey world, you call them a yard bird. But it's a yard deer that's just hanging out in the thicket that's a quarter acre that's right next to the shop.
Gotcha. Okay, so now, as expected, this podcast really didn't have a topic that we stuck to the entire time, but that's why we call it a BS session. Kind of going back to this magic number 170, right? Everybody talks about booners. You know, booners, got to put down a booner. This guy put down a booner. Yeah, he's a great hunter because he put down a booner. Okay, whatever. But what percent of deer that make it to, let's say, 5.5 years old? I don't even know if you guys have a data for this, or just maybe a best guess. What percentage of deer that hit that magic number of 5.5 or older actually hit 170?
Yeah, I don't think there's a number to put out there, but I'll just say, if you're saying 170 is like the superior genetics,
yeah,
how many people have the genetics to make it to a professional athlete? Not many.
Yeah.
I think it's very similar. They have superior genetics to be able to do those things, whether it's baseball or basketball. Same thing with deer. There's not a lot that have they don't have it in them to make it to 170.
Yeah.
To make it to 170.
Yeah, and if you're asking across the entire whitetails range, that no way to, I don't think, compute that number. But it's a small fraction of deer. Again, you're going to have pockets that have, you know, the majority of a 5.5 year old deer may reach that. But a lot of areas they won't hit that. You'll have, like Adam said, those if you will, freaks of nature that just kind of pop up. And you're like, oh my gosh, how did that happen? Well, you know, he found a place, he got old, and he had good nutrition, and he hit that mark. But I don't, certainly not to my knowledge, there's not that number out there, that basically research that would be credible. But if so, it'd be a pretty small number. I mean, that's why they're called trophies. I mean, because they don't happen every single day.
Right.
And again, not every area, not every state has the age structure that would even allow for that to happen on a regular basis. There's probably some portions of some states that, yeah, I've got the resources available to do that, but the age structure just isn't even there.
Yeah. 170, right? Again, magic number. Everybody wants to shoot a booner, booner, booner.
Maybe. Well, yeah. After this podcast, I'm shooting a forked horn next bow season.
Good for you, buddy.
Yeah.
The hunting industry has a lot to do with setting these unrealistic expectations for hunters, right? Like if you don't know any better and you watch outdoor television, you're going to think, oh my God, I want to shoot a booner. I'm going to go out and I'm not going to shoot a deer until I shoot a 170 inch deer. And obviously we know through this conversation and just being, good listeners and knowing that those animals are very rare to not only from a genetic standpoint, but also to from a management standpoint, to get one to live on your property and stay on your property, right? So do you think that for hunting overall, this is another curveball in this conversation. For hunting overall, do you think that the hunting industry, the products, advertisements, the television shows do more good for hunting or bad for hunting?
Damn.
This is a BS.
That was our
session.
Careers right here.
Yeah. Dude. No, this seriously was the bust. I don't know if anyone can hear it, but it's backing up, getting ready to roll over top of
beep,
us.
Beep, beep, beep. Oh,
dude,
you know what?
It hit me a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, you're still around.
I would say
I'll say it.
I mean, we're not scared to say it. We say this a lot behind the mic when the microphones aren't on. But yeah, I would have to say that I think we've come to a point where the expectations, and not just the expectations, but the pressure, I think might be the right word, of shooting a deer that's not the caliber that you see on outdoor television is a bad thing, to where a new hunter coming onto the scene, maybe it's a 13-year-old boy, maybe it's a 35-year-old guy who for some reason he's just got the urge to pick up hunting. Whenever you watch somebody else doing something on television and they're killing a giant deer and you're like, oh, that's cool, but on my farm I don't have them, I'm going to go out and shoot a young deer or the first buck. But then the pressure of somebody may saying, I can't believe you didn't let that deer grow. Dead deer don't grow. I think that's had a huge negative with it.
Right. Right.
To me, again, you're it's almost like you're shooting for the stars out of the gate. And that can be a frustrating thing to do. Now, I think setting goals is important? Absolutely. But that doesn't mean as a novice or a beginner that you need to have that, or even as a seasoned hunter, a veteran hunter, that you have to achieve that. No, it's a predetermined individual goal that every person should have. Mm-hmm. You know, some people that want to shoot a 170, man, go out and get it. Absolutely. But there's other people who want to go out there and get meat on the table for their family or just enjoy venison as is, man, go and do that. That's the sport of hunting. It's not necessarily a trophy.
As corny as it sounds, trophies in the eye of the beholder.
It really is. And I firmly believe that. Like Adam said, there's a lot of pressure right now put on this 170 marker or a Booner or a 4.5-year-old deer. I can't tell. I've shot more bucks in my life that aren't 4.5 or older.
Right.
Then, I mean, to me, you've got to start somewhere. And even again, if you're a veteran hunter and you're 60 years old and you want to shoot a 2.5-year-old buck, man, all the power to you, because you have that opportunity. You have the ability. And I'm not going to knock you for it. Go out and do it.
What I want out of hunting, or whatever the industry does, at the end of the day, I hope the one thing it does is get people to buy tags and go hunting.
Absolutely.
That's it. And I think that for me, there was a time in my life where at 20 years old or whatever, I would get irritated at my neighbors for shooting young bucks and would get downright mad. And now at 30, I kind of look here and I go, you know what? As long as he's buying tags and going hunting and trying to get other people into it, good for him. I'll tip my cap to him. Because if I sit here and bash my neighbors to a point where none of them want to go hunting or whatever, at some point I'm the lone wolf out here hunting, then there's a better chance that in a big picture somebody's going to vote out my rights of hunting.
Right.
That's for sure. Yeah, that's just the truth of it. You know, we as hunters, we got to lock arms and say, hey, you're a hunter, I'm a hunter. It doesn't matter what your standard is, but just know that you're a hunter and I'm a hunter, and that's what matters.
Yeah, I think of another example that I used to be very anti-crossbow. And up until a few years ago, Missouri only allowed basically handicapped people to use crossbows, but they made it legal for everyone. And at first I thought, oh, that's, I hate that. But now I look at it, I'm like, you know what? Now there's a bunch of kids who are able to go hunting during bow season because they can carry a crossbow. So I think it's awesome now.
Right.
And a lot of our clients are folks who reach out to us for consulting. Honestly, a large majority of them are very family devoted, and they say, you know what, I want the opportunity to harvest an older age class buck, but what I really want is a lot of animals on the farm, so when I can bring my kids out here, I know that they're going to have a good time. They're going to see deer. They're going to have the opportunity to harvest deer. And yeah, I'd like to have my shot or two, or you know, throughout a season at that mature buck. But man, that's an awesome goal, in my opinion, is looking beyond just, you know, an age or a number of inches of antler, but looking to enjoy wildlife, observe them, and share that moment with your kids or even a neighbor's kid, whoever it may be, or just a new hunter. That's awesome.
Yeah. And I mentioned it earlier, but for us, Matt and I, we've been consultants now over a year with our own company, Land and Legacy. And if anybody has priced consultants, whatever, I think I kind of pride ourselves on being a more affordable consultants because of the fact that we get to be on more properties that way. There's more people that can afford us. And the more people that we get to interact with and the more farms we get to see, hopefully we get to spread that message or reinforce that message with them about improving the habitat, leaving a legacy of improved habitat for future generations to enjoy. But in the process, we're going to have more animals, and hopefully we can introduce more hunters.
Right, right. And I'll add on something on that just real quick, and that is I get excited when my friends kill deer, and any deer, right? Whether it's a doe or a big buck or a forky horn like you're going to do this upcoming year. But
with a recurve.
With a recurve. Hey, that's a win right there, bud. But when I shouldn't care. I think we get caught up in caring too much about how an animal is harvested and where it was harvested and what the inches are, when we shouldn't care at all about those things. The only thing that we should care about is that this person harvested a deer doing what they love, period, end of story, and not about all the other crap. Like, the details are fun because that's what makes a good story, but caring about, like, oh, he shot it in Iowa, of course that buck's bigger, or, you know, he shot it on private ground, or he shot it with a crossbow, or who gives a shit? If you did it legally, it's all good in my book, man.
Yep.
Bingo. Bingo.
You truer words have never been spoken, Dan.
I just plagiarized that entire sentence. But anyway, gentlemen, I hear my kid screaming. So that brings us to the end of this podcast.
And, Daddy duty.
Daddy duty, right, right. So, hey, guys, I really appreciate you taking time to come on the podcast. And basically, I don't even know what I'm going to title this episode. It might just be Nine Fingers plus Land and Legacy equals Skip This Podcast.
Maybe call it 29 Fingers.
29 Fingers. Hey, that's a good idea. I might have to roll with that. I might have to roll with that. All right. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Huge shout out to Adam and Matt for coming on the podcast and taking time to chat a little bit about the habitat side of things on whether or not money can buy big bucks. And I would love to hear what your thoughts on this topic are as well. So go to the Nine Finger Chronicles Facebook page, and on the post that mentions this podcast, I would love to hear your thoughts. Continue this conversation there. And, you know, I'm just curious what everybody else has to think. I know my opinion doesn't mean anything. So, again, I'd love to hear what you guys have to say. Huge shout out to all of you who take the time to download this podcast, who listen to it, who are, I guess, customers, basically preferred customers of the podcast, who listen to it every week. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Huge shout out to all of the partners of this podcast: Exodus, Wasp, Gearhead, Ozonix, Lone Wolf, Bighorn Outfitters. And I think that's it. 1, 2, 3, 4, five, six, seven. Ripcord Arrow Rest. Yeah, Ripcord. There you go. Thanks to all of those who support this podcast. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast, because honestly, without them, this does not happen. Go to social media and find the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network on Facebook and Instagram. Please go like it. Go share it. Tell your friends about it. There is a lot of buzz being generated about this. And the more that we can do on that end, the more that we can do as far as putting out content is concerned. So the more that you guys share it and talk about it, the more that we can do on our end to provide you guys good content. And go to iTunes, leave a review, or go to wherever you download your podcast and leave a review. And I think that's it, guys. So the seasons are kind of winding down for everybody, but if you are either going into the timber to do some habitat work, to take down or move some tree stands, please wear your damn safety harness. Have a good week.